Psalm 35, verse 19. My treacherous enemies will not be happy concerning me. Those who gratuitously hate me wink an eye. These are the enemies, as we already saw in verse 15, that have already been happy or rejoicing or gloating over him. Because it looks like they're going to get their way and that David's going to go down. These folks are operating out of falsehood. Sheker is the word I translated treacherous there. Sheker is falsehood, deception. They're wrong to be his enemies. They're characterized by hate and animosity. They don't even have a good reason to hate him. They've already demonstrated that causeless hate in verse 7 by laying pits and snares for him. David mentions their winking eyes in verse 19. And you put that together with that word, parallel word, sheker. It's winking is a physical acting out of falsehood. It's saying one thing and then you wink to let them know, well, you really meant the opposite of what you just said. Or maybe it's a pre-planned signal to third parties who are also enemies to carry out their part of their scheme of against David. I imagine this must have been something that impacted David, that he put it in his psalm, and that he must have talked with his son about too, because it shows up three times in the Proverbs and nowhere else in the Bible, this winking. Maybe this is one of the... Maybe David's... what David learned from people that winked and were duplicitous, he passed that on to Solomon, and that may have been part of Solomon's wisdom. So Proverbs 6:12 said, a worthless person, a wicked man, walks with a perverse mouth, winks with his eyes, shuffles his feet, points with his fingers. Perversity is in his heart. He devises evil continually. He sows discord, and therefore his calamity shall come suddenly, and suddenly he shall be broken without remedy. Justice will come. God's justice will come to these kind of people. Proverbs 10:10, he who winks with the eye causes trouble, and a prating fool will fall. Proverbs 16:29, a violent man entices his neighbor and leads him in a way that's not good. He winks his eye to devise perverse things, purses his lips, and brings about evil. As I mentioned in, I think it was the last sermon, in this psalm we have verb forms which can be translated either future tense, my enemies will not rejoice, or they can be translated in a jussive interpretation, let them not rejoice. And as I mentioned last week, the two are related. There's no sense praying for what we know God doesn't want. So if we can first say with the future sense that this is true, in this case, if the enemies of God's people will ultimately not be happy, then we can pray for it. In the justice sense, let them not be happy then. If you know your request lines up with God's character and with God's revealed will, you can pray for God's will to be done against enemies. And you can pray with confidence. Verse 20, he goes on, it's not peace they seek, rather it's words of deception that they think up against those who are settling on the land. We've already seen a portrait of this enemy back in Psalm 10. With arrogance, a wicked man hotly pursues a lowly man, and they'll be caught in schemes that they thought up because the wicked man boasted over his selfish desires, and it was the greedy that he blessed. The Lord he despised. A wicked man, according to the stuck-upness of his nose, will never be a seeker of God. In all his schemes, he assumes there's no God. His ways are circuitous during every moment. God's judgments are high above the presence of his mind. And as for all his adversaries, he blows them off. He says in his heart, I'll never be overthrown, will never be in bad times for generations and generations. It's a curse that fills his mouth. Also deceit and oppression under his tongue are trouble and iniquity. He sits in ambush in the hiding place as he murders an innocent man. His eyes single out the weakest, and he sets an ambush in the hiding place like a lion in a den. The weakest crumple and are brought down and fall by his powers. This is the kind of person that is on David's, threatening David. David refers to himself as one of the quiet or the settled of the earth. The first time that word occurs, the quiet or settled, is in the list of curses in Deuteronomy 28:65, where it says, if you don't love and obey God, you won't be able to settle down peacefully there. And Jeremiah 50 states the converse positively. Their Redeemer is strong. The Lord of hosts is his name. He will plead for their case that he may give rest. There's the verb again. And disquiet the inhabitants of Babylon. So those who are quiet or settled in the land are those who are living in covenant with God, not under his curse, but under his blessing, to be able to settle the land. It's just another way to say those who've been made right with God are the target of the enemy's deception and false accusations. I want you to begin noticing how much this enemy resembles Satan. Verse 21, they've opened their mouth wide over me. They say, aha, aha, our eyes saw. And the picture here seems to be of false witnesses accusing David of things he didn't actually do. And when he denies in court that he did the things, the witnesses yell, but we saw you do it. They open their mouths wide to say, ha, you're going down, Buster. And it's in a hopeless situation like this that David cries out for God to intervene. He says, Lord Yahweh, you saw it. Don't you be silent. My master, don't be far from me. David knows that God sees all things, no matter what these false witnesses say they saw. God saw what actually happened. And he's asking God to stick close and witness to the truth. Now, there are times when God seems to keep his distance, so to speak, and to allow trials like this to come upon us. But scriptures remind us that his eye is still always on us. He never actually leaves us or forsakes us. David is praying that this will not be one of those times when God keeps his distance, because this is no mere trial. This enemy's out for blood. It's like his earlier prayer in Psalm 28. It's to you, O Lord, my landmark rock that I call. You must not be silent in regard to me. Because if you sit still in regard to me, then I will be in the same boat with those who go down to the pit. Once again, David invokes the covenant relationship he has with God by calling God by his covenant name, Yahweh, or Jehovah, or Lord in all caps. And also by referring to the role relationship that this God has with him. Adonai, my Lord, my master, my owner. And if you are my master and my owner, then you have a responsibility for me because I'm your property. So after these two negative commands, don't be silent, don't be far away, David issues two positive commands to God in verse 23. Please mobilize justice for me, my God and my master. Put yourself on the alert for arguing my case. The first command that David gives to God there to stir up or awaken or mobilize for David's judgment or his rights, his defense, he's used before in Psalm 7. Arise, O Lord, in your anger. be lifted up by the excesses of my adversaries, and stir up, there's the same verb, stir up for me the justice or judgment you decreed. I get the idea that David is saying to himself, so Saul or Absalom or whoever it is wants to play hardball here. It's time for me to call in the best lawyer there is. When God mobilizes a case and crafts the legal arguments, he never loses. Of course, God never sleeps. So David's behests of God are not literally to wake up so much as to take a special interest in my case. Bail me out here because I'm being falsely accused of treason in Saul's case. And falsely accused of injustice in Absalom's case. In verse 24, he says, execute justice for me, O Lord, my God, according to your righteousness, so they will not be happy concerning me. And the they here is the treacherous enemies from verse 19, who are gloating over David's misfortune, smug and happy, that it looks like David's going to lose and that they're going to be in control. In verse 26, they're happy about David getting hurt, happy over his distress, happy over his calamities. So David is calling for an upset in the corrupt judicial system, for God, the ultimate judge, to step in and correct the injustice that's going on by executing justice according to his righteousness, instead of justice being executed by crooked politicians according to their corrupt desires. And this tzedek righteousness is a key term in the final verses of this psalm. In the midst of a hopeless situation, David clings to ultimate truths. There is a God. That God is righteous. That God is going to judge mankind. And joy and happiness belong to God and his people ultimately, not to those in rebellion against God. These bedrock truths that are revealed in God's word are what David clings to in the teeth of evil. When it looks like God is not near. When it looks like God is not bringing justice. When it looks like righteousness is going to lose. When it looks like it's the bad guys who are going to be happy. In faith, we too must cling to these bedrock ultimate truths that we know will characterize eternity, even when it looks like they aren't happening now. We too can call these ultimate truths of God's presence, God's justice, God's righteousness, and God's joy down into the here and now through prayer. Just like David. Continuing to verse 25, don't let them say in their heart, aha, our dream come true. Don't let them say we've swallowed him up. This talk in the inner self of the wicked, they say in their heart, reveals the orientation of the thoughts of the enemies of God. And it's literally nefeshnu, our soul. It's self-centeredness, a preoccupation with self, and it's one-upmanship. We've swallowed him up. We beat him. Ultimately, it's stealing, killing, and destroying, like Jesus said Satan was out to do. We know that's the orientation of the thoughts of Satan, is this kind of destruction, swallowing up the righteous. Just as Saul became insanely fixed on killing David, and Absalom became insensibly consumed with killing his brother and unseating his father as king, they think it'll bring you some. They'll bring them some kind of satisfaction to bring you down. There's always going to be people on this earth who think they're doing God a favor to kill Christians. We've seen that throughout history, from the rampages of Saul of Tarsus against the early church, to the pagan Roman Catholic massacres of Protestant Christians in Europe, to the modern-day terror tactics of atheists and Buddhists and Muslims against Christian communities. In the context of of these kinds of threats from evil, this is the pattern that we have for how to pray. Habakkuk also gave us a pattern for praying in the face of this kind of evil. He said, "O Lord, are you not from everlasting? My God, my Holy One, we will not die. You, O Lord, have appointed them to judge. You, O Rock, have established them to correct. Your eyes are too pure to approve evil. With you, wickedness cannot dwell. Why do you look with favor on those who deal treacherously? Why are you silent when the wicked swallow up those more righteous than they?" And I've underlined words in Habakkuk that are the same as words in Psalm 35. And of course, God answered Habakkuk to say that he was divinely orchestrating the Chaldean armies to chastise the unfaithful among his people and to mature faith among the faithful remnant of his people. And God promised when he's done with the Chaldean army, he's going to destroy them and bring salvation to his people. It's a matter of timing with God's purposes. Verse 26, "Those who are happy about evil happening to me will experience shame and will blush together. Those trying to be great against me will wear shame and embarrassment." These folks who are magnifying or exalting themselves against David and seeking self-aggrandizement would certainly fit the description of Absalom and his cohorts, who are trying to take over the country and kill David and the rulers loyal to David. This point in the cyclical structure of Psalm 35 matches verses 4 and 5, where David said, "Those who seek to end my life will experience shame and embarrassment. Those who think up evil against me will be turned back and blush. They'll be like chaff before the wind while the angel of the Lord shoves them down." Like verses 4 and 5, verse 26 can also be legitimately translated in the form of a wish for the adversaries to blush with shame, like most English, modern English versions have done. It can just as legitimately be interpreted as a faith statement about what will happen in the future as well when God fulfills justice. There's a link between God and his people. Jesus said, "The world will hate us because it hated him." And the Apostle John said, "If you love God, you'll love the Christian Brotherhood. You can't love God and hate your brother." There's a link. When you experience the hatred of the world against you, it's because they also hate God. And because of that, they are on God's radar to receive just punishment. In the case of this psalm, the bad guys are fighting against David. They're persecuting him. Verse 3, they're seeking to end his life, thinking up evil plans to do that in verse 4. Digging pits and setting up traps in verse 7. They're robbers, verse 10. They're violent terrorists, verse 11. They're repaying evil for good, verse 12. They're either literally cutting and hitting and injuring David or figuratively slandering him, verse 15. Mocking, scoffing, using profanity, verse 16. Wreaking destruction, verse 17. Filled with hate, verse 19. Saying things that are false, verse 19. Trying to deceive, verse 21. Their desire is to see David swallowed up, like Jonah and the whale, erased from the land of the living, verse 25. They're happy when people get hurt. This is the characterization of these enemies that we see listed here in this psalm. This is part of David's case that he's making with God. This is why they're evil. This is why you must punish them, God. If David's perception is even partly accurate concerning these folks, there's no doubt that with this much hatred and animosity against a man after God's own heart, they must be equally antagonistic to God and therefore rightfully deserve blows of justice. But note that David is not doing the same thing back that they are doing to him. He's not plotting ways to torture them and get revenge. He's not saying, "Oh Lord, slash them with whips until they bleed and fill their bowels with sickness until they're miserable and make their children slaves." And he's not coming up with new creative ways for them to suffer. Instead, David's just asking to be delivered. Don't let them rejoice over me getting killed. And so that they're not going to feel triumphant about evil. He's asking God to make them aware that what they're doing is wrong. That's what shame is about. Fill them with shame. He's just asking God, help them to see that what they're doing is wrong. That's not revenge. That's asking for God's will to be done on earth as it is in heaven. We see similar prayers in Psalms 70, 71, and 83. And in Psalm 83, that purpose of not revenge, but righteousness really comes out clear. Pursue them. Psalm 83, starting at verse 15. Pursue them with your tempest and frighten them with your storm. Fill their faces with shame that they may seek your name. Fill them with shame so that they will seek your name. See? Let them be confounded and dismayed forever. Yes, let them be put to shame and perish. Why? That they may know that you, whose name alone is Yahweh, are the Most High over all the earth. Why does he want them to feel shame? So that they will see who God really is. God's people don't call down shame on the wicked because we want to see the wicked suffer. We ask God to move shame from its misplaced place on us, that the world has projected on us, to its proper place of conviction of sin upon sinners, so that the wicked themselves might be made right with God. It's entirely appropriate to pray for God to bring shame upon the hearts of people who are doing wrong. And by the way, David's prayer prophecy here in Psalm 35 really did come true. When you think of Absalom and Ahithophel, they're not the ones that lived happily ever after, are they? David is the one that was in the triumphal procession back into Jerusalem as king in 2 Samuel 19. David's the one singing out in his victory psalm in 2 Samuel 22. When you think of Absalom, you think of a failed coup. You think of a dishonorable son who usurped a good king. Think of a foppish young man who grew out his hair so long that he got tangled in a tree where he died. Many such wicked men never do get right with God. But you can see that to the end, David hoped for Absalom's redemption. Now we get to the commentary on the righteous, the good outcome. Verse 27, those who are inclined towards righteousness, happening to me, will sing out and be happy. Those who are inclined toward the peace of his servant will always say, "The Lord is great." God's people, instead of delighting and hurting and swallowing up the righteous, like the wicked do in verse 25, are instead happy because they align their desires with God's righteousness and with God's people. I'm going with the reading of the Dead Sea Scrolls here and of the Septuagint, both of which are about 1,000 years older than the Masoretic text that most of the modern English versions follow. The modern versions attribute the delighting in the welfare of the servant to God, but that doesn't make a big difference really, because alignment with God's desires is the very definition of righteousness. So whether it's God or God's people delighting in the peace of God's people, there's not a contradiction here in Scripture. If what God says is right is what you love to see happen, then you're going to be on the right side of history. you're going to come out happily praising God. Being in the right is a key concept here at the end of the psalm. The Hebrew word tzedek, righteousness, that's translated vindication in verse 27, and it's translated righteousness in verse 24, righteousness in verse 28. In verse 26, we see the wicked humanists magnifying themselves, trying to be great. Hifl form of gadol, to be great. They're trying to be great, trying to cause greatness. And that is in contrast in verse 7 with the God who already is great. Yigdal, he is great. It's his state of being. His people who align themselves with God and proclaiming God's greatness. The contrast couldn't be any more stark. The biblical proclamation of God's greatness, by the way, bears no comparison to Islam. Muslims are often heard to verbally affirm God is great, Allahu Akbar, but at every turn, their actions contradict their words. Constant intervention of religious and political leaders and the constant vigilantism of terrorists affirm that they don't believe Allah is actually all that great, but rather that Allah needs human help in order to establish justice. Muslims, of course, aren't the only religion that do that. Throughout history, there have been plenty of so-called Christians, too, who've compromised so much with humanism that they have tried to step in and help God out. There's a world of difference between man-centered religion and the doctrine of a God who establishes justice in the face of corruption and violence, which David expresses in this psalm. And that's why he says in the final verse, my tongue will meditate on your righteousness all day long. It'll meditate on your praise. That verb, haga, or feminine singular, tahaga, because the tongue is feminine singular. We haven't seen that verb since Psalms 1 and 2. In Psalm 1, haga is what the righteous do with God's law day and night. And in Psalm 2, it's what the wicked do in their vain plans to overthrow the Lord. Repeat it to themselves. Murmur it. Think on it over and over again, hardly thinking of anything else. That's what David says his tongue will do regarding God's righteousness and praise. He's going to meditate on it, murmur it over and over, repeatedly affirm verbally God's righteousness and praise. Now, I want to take all this in a direction that's different from what I did with the last two sermons. So far, I've applied it mostly in terms of physical enemies and applied it to how the phrases of this psalm relate to the animosity of David's son, Absalom, as well as of the king before him, Saul. But I want to consider all that's said in this psalm at a deeper spiritual level. Okay, there's the stuff on that, verse 28. Consider how this matches the work of the devil. Going back through the Psalms, verse 19 speaks of someone who hates a follower of God for no reason. When a person of the world hates us, is he not merely reflecting the hatred towards us that our enemy, the devil, has? And when they speak lies, are they not merely speaking according to their spiritual father, the devil, who is the original liar? Verse 20 speaks of the enemy's thoughts and scheming. Doesn't this match what we see of the devil in the opening chapters of the book of Job? He's preoccupied with scheming, coming up with ways to get Job to lose faith in God. And then think of the picture in verse 21. A hate-filled enemy pointing his finger in damnation, accusing you over and over again, bringing to your mind over and over again every little thing you've done wrong. Sometimes even accusing you of things you've done that weren't actually wrong, but trying to make you feel guilt anyway. Is that not why Satan is called the devil, the accuser, the diabolos? Is that not why in Revelation 12:10 he's called the accuser of the brethren, standing before the throne of God, constantly finding fault with us? This is his modus operandi, to mercilessly accuse and try to make you live under shame. Not only does Satan harp on your sins in your own mind in order to keep you from asking for forgiveness and to keep you from believing that you've been forgiven, he's also our accuser before God, reminding God, as though God's not perfectly aware himself, of all our offenses against him. The portrait of the devil that C.S. Lewis paints as the accuser of the brethren before God in the Chronicles of Narnia is poignant, I think. The devil character is the White Witch. She strides up to Aslan, the Lion Christ figure, says, "You have a traitor there, Aslan." Of course, everyone present knew she meant Edmund. But Edmund had gotten past thinking about himself after all he'd been through and after the talk that he'd had that morning with Aslan. He just went on looking at Aslan. Didn't seem to matter what the witch said now. "Well," said Aslan, "his offense was not against you." "Have you forgotten the deep magic?" asked the witch. "You know that every traitor belongs to me as my lawful prey, and for that every treachery I have a right to a kill. And so," continued the witch, "that human creature is mine. His life is forfeit to me. His blood is my property." And if you know the story, Aslan acknowledges that's true, and then offers himself to die in Edmund's place at the hands of the witch. And only then does she relinquish her claims on Edmund's life. Verse 25 speaks of the adversary's goal to swallow the godly up. Is that not what the Apostle Peter said in his first epistle? Your opponent, the devil, goes around like a lying lion seeking for someone that he might swallow down. He'd love nothing more than to see you taken out of commission, Christian. Verse 26 spoke of the enemy's self-aggrandizement, seeking to magnify himself over his rightful authority. Doesn't that characterize Satan's attitude towards God that you see in Isaiah 14 characterized? How are you fallen from the heavens, day star, son of the dawn? You said in your heart, "I will ascend to the heavens. Above the stars of God, I'll set my throne on high, and I'll make myself like the Most High." That attitude of seeking to be great comes from Satan originally. So whether or not you have a physical enemy, you know, at your office or in your home, making trouble for you, you do have a supernatural foe who is cunningly preying on your own human weaknesses and is hell-bent on getting you to sin and on destroying you. Satan nails me from time to time to the point that I feel as panicky as David does here in Psalm 35. And when that happens, I need to trust Jesus to deliver me. I need to look forward to rejoicing when Satan is brought to justice. The late Dr. James Boyce, when he preached on this psalm, observed, "We can apply the word of this psalm to the devil, for he is described in Scripture precisely as David describes his enemies. We are like helpless sheep before this powerful enemy. But thank God we have a powerful champion and advocate in King Jesus. It is not wrong for us to pray for his help, for the confounding of Satan's devices, and to rejoice in anticipation of the devil's ultimate and certain fall." I want to close with 5 applications, examples that David gives us for taking this to a spiritual level of warfare against Satan. The first is, when temptation to sin becomes powerful, we can pray, Lord, don't let Satan have any cause for rejoicing over this. That's a biblical prayer. Lord, Satan is trying to magnify himself against you by encouraging me to sin against you. Please bring him to shame and humiliation for his rebellion against you. Confound his plans for my destruction. Lord, you told John in the book of Revelation you're going to throw Satan into that bottomless pit. Bring it on. William Plummer, do I have his quote? Yep, says to his commentary on the Psalms from the early 1900s, I think. He said, to ask that the wicked may not prevail against us or insult us is to beseech God to exercise his glorious attributes in a manner suited to beget godly fear and firm confidence. You save me, godly fear and confidence in God are going to go up. Do it, God. A second strategy here is recognize that Satan's currency is deception. The sin that you find tempting is only alluring because it presents as true something that is poisonously false. If you take the bait, it's going to take away your peace. But if you can identify the lie that's at the root of it, it can cause the sin to lose power over you. When you experience the attraction of sin, look for the lie. This is a false witness, God. Bring it to shame by exposing the truth here, by exposing what is untrue about it. And when the accusing thoughts come in because you fell into sin in the past and you're being reminded of it, or because you've just fell into sin again and Satan says you're hopeless, God's never going to accept you, you need to get out of the business of being your own lawyer and call in the big guns. Pray like David did in verses 20 through 24. Lord, you understand what's going on, Jesus, so take over as my defense attorney. You are my God. You are my master. I am your child. I am your servant. Instead of me trying to be good enough, put your own righteousness in for me and execute justice and make everything right. My sin and my treachery against you does make me Satan's lawful prey, but you forfeited your life on the cross in my place to satisfy the claims of the enemy of my soul, and he must relinquish his claims. So fight for me. Be my shield. I know you will win. And struggle for your own spiritual life. Don't give up. Don't give in. Verse 25, when sin feels inevitable, you're out of control, your head is going under, fight for your spiritual life by asking God along the lines of verse 25, Lord, save me. Don't let them say they've swallowed me up. I don't want to be swallowed up by Satan and pass over into his dominion. I don't want to be swallowed up by sin and become a slave of sin again. Lord, it cannot be. I believe you bought me with your blood. You can't let me be swallowed up. And then the fifth strategy, is to fill your mind with God's truth so it spills out of your mouth. Notice these three speech-oriented things that are continuous. Verse 27, affirming not once or twice, but continually, always, that God is great. Speaking this continuously, God is great. You can handle any of this, God. And then verse 28, this meditative repeating over and over again in spoken words what God's righteousness is, what his laws are, how he keeps them with perfect integrity, how he's also given us his righteousness, who can't keep his righteousness, and he's given us his righteousness through Jesus and the imputation of his righteousness. And then praise, praising God every Sunday morning, right? No, praising God all day long, every day. What is going to give you the ammunition, the fuel to be able to do all day long, to continually speak of God's greatness, to meditatively repeat this? What does it take in order for that much to flow out of your mouth? It's for that much to be going into your mind as well. It's to fill your mind with God's word so that it's there. It can come out. This is the other strategy. The positive strategy when we deal with sin is your heart's got to be full of something. If it's going to be empty of sin, it needs to be full of God's righteousness. Well, may God give every one of you the encouragement to continue the fight against sin and Satan with the certain knowledge that Jesus has gone before you. He has conquered Satan, and victory is assured, and justice against evil is coming. It is certain, and it is worth continuing to trust Jesus and continuing to fight against evil, because he will deliver his people. He will bring evil to justice. And I believe that's the message of Psalm 35.